the 19th century, Ireland lost half of its population to famine, emigration to the United States and Canada, and the forced transportation of convicts to Australia. The ancestors of our guest today, Thomas Keneally, who lives in Australia, were among the victims of that tragedy. If the name sounds familiar, Keneally is the author of the award-winning book Schindler's List, which was the inspiration for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film. Thomas Keneally is with us today to talk about his latest best-selling book on the bit of Irish history to which I just referred, and it is titled The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking World. Welcome, Mr. Keneally, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great honor. Thank you.
Let's start off by having you explain to us, if you would, the part of the title, The Great Shame. What does that refer to?
Well, as I say at the end of the book, it has a number of meanings, but I think that there's no getting away from the fact that a great shame attached to the government at Westminster, the British government of the day, in its maladministration of Ireland and in its maladministration of the famine. There were many reasons for that maladministration, which I try to explain in the book, but of course they produced it produced a great trigger of immigration and politics, that is, it produced the famine. And so the primary meaning of the great shame was that Ireland was actually, compared to where I come from, Australia, another part of the British Empire, Ireland very badly governed.
So, at least in this sense of the word or of the phrase, you're in the school of historians that suggests that it was the maladministration that made the famine much worse than it might have been under ordinary circumstances.
Yes, and needless to say, like most people, I'm in favor of the peace process, but I don't think that the peace process is helped at all by fudging these issues. I explain in the book, for example, that the British people showed an exceptional compassion for the Irish through its donations to the British Association, which was an NGO, an aid body operating in Ireland, and that the British people thus showed greater goodwill than the British government. Of course, I've never been a supporter of the concept, which, as I explained in the book, began to gain form in the late 1860s, that for the sake of the famine, for the sake of the peculiar griefs of Ireland, random Englishmen and women on the street should have to die by dynamiting. I've never belonged to that school. On the other hand, I've never belonged to the school that says, well, we mustn't say these things because it might encourage a problem. I think that to confront and forgive is the way to go, and I was heartened during the writing of the book by the fact that Prime Minister Blair of Great Britain apologized for the misgovernment of Ireland at the time of the famine.
Right. Now, the second part of the title, The Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking World, what did you mean to suggest there?
Well, I have to confess, Dr. LeBeau, that unlike a strict scholar like yourself, I was influenced by my editor, Nan Talese, at Doubleday to sling that one in, that subtitle in, but there was a triumph. What is amazing is that few immigrants, other than, of course, the slaves of Africa, from Africa, arrived in the Americas or in Australia in a worse condition than the Irish. Of course, some of the ones sent to Australia were convicts, like my wife's and my forebears. But they did very quickly begin to garner a position for themselves in mainstream society. And the history of the Irish in America has been the success of that ascent. I deal in the book with some ironies of this triumph. One of my most beloved convicts who served time in Australia was an Irish political prisoner called Thomas Francis Maher, an extraordinarily engaging figure. But when Maher went to Montana, escaped to the U.S., was a Civil War general, and then went to Montana as governor, his sense of the dispossession of the Irish did not extend itself to the Flathead Indians on the west of the Rockies or to the Blackfoot on the east of the Rockies. He felt that they could easily sacrifice more of their land, and he couldn't understand their particular ancestral passion for the land because they didn't seem to be doing a lot with it. So that one of the dents in the triumph was that the Irish did not always extend their experience, the imagination they received from being oppressed themselves, to later comers to America or to former African slaves or to Native Americans. But there was a triumph as organizations like Tammany Hall began to use the Irish as political cannon fodder, as electors, meeting them at the ship and immediately enrolling them as voters. The Irish refused to be merely electoral cannon fodder and began to find their own place. And that happened, that same political impulse happened even with the Irish radicals and rural protesters who were sent as convicts to Australia too. The Irish political imagination, I think, Dr. Lebeau, came very strongly from the influence of the Liberator, Daniel O'Connell, mm-hmm. who had involved the ordinary tenant farmers and peasants of Ireland in two mass movements. One was Catholic emancipation to achieve the an end to any discriminatory laws against Catholics, and the second was the repeal movement to cancel mm-hmm. the connection between Britain and Ireland by constitutional, non-violent means. And ordinary peasants, like my wife's great-grandparents, my wife's great-grandfather, before he was transported, were allowed to belong to these associations. And though they had no vote at all, they were behind the man who spoke for them in Westminster. And so Daniel O'Connell and his Irish party. So the Irish got a powerful political sense from this experience, and it helped them to triumph in America and indeed in most of the New World.
You know, you make several good points in there. One that I'd like to pick up on, and it's sort of a wake-up call to those of us historians who get too narrowly focused, is how difficult it is to understand an aspect of history without making the connections that you make in your book. We study Irish immigration to the United States. We don't focus terribly on what's going on in Ireland, and we never touch on what's going on in Australia. Yet in several of your characters, they come to the United States, like Maher, through Australia as criminals. So there's a connection here that I think you stress very well in your book.
Yes, and indeed, you find in the book an extraordinary alliance between a Yankee Protestant temperance sea captains who are willing to liberate from Australian prisoners, Australian prisons, various Irish prisoners who are, of course, different in culture, different in religion, probably different in drinking habits too. And this is one of the most fascinating alliances of the 19th century, the alliance between the disgruntled Yankee captain who helps political prisoners escape to the U.S. And the Irish radical who comes to the U.S. and, of course, gets involved, as Maher did, in Democrat politics. And it is a fascinating story in this sense that through Thomas Francis Maher, you can look at, through all of these convicts, you can look at Ireland, the grievances of Ireland, what politicised people. You can look at the Australian exile of these people who were shipped off 120, 130 days at sea, in many cases in chains or battened down on the prison deck. And you can see the Australian experience through their eyes. You can then follow them in their escapes, in their various spectacular escapes from Australia, often on whalers, and follow them into America. Mm-hmm. And you become aware that, very like Zionism in the 20th century, the Irish movement in the 19th century was an international one, in that money for various Irish enterprises, including revolutionary enterprises, but also famine relief and hardship relief, that was an international movement. And this is shown towards the end of the book, when the Clan na Gael, a large Irish revolutionary organization in the United States, gathers money, buys a New Bedford whaler, and dispatches it throughout across the world to Western Australia to rescue the last of the life-serving Fenians or Irish Republicans there in 1876. Now, the money to buy that whaler came from California, where a great uncle of mine, a liberated prisoner from Australia, was the treasurer of the movement. It came from Chicago. It came from Cincinnati. It came from New York and Boston. It also came from Montreal. It came from the gold fields of New Zealand, where the Irish were rife. Wherever there was a gold field, you had the Irish. It came from the gold fields of Queensland, where the Irish were rife, Queensland being a northern state of Australia. It came from New South Wales, my state. So you had a sense of an international movement, with the left hand knowing what the right hand was doing, which spanned the Pacific Ocean, spanned the Atlantic. And I think, therefore, that what you said earlier is correct. It's hard to get the holistic picture unless you do follow one of these prisoners from place to place, from Ireland into exile in Australia, into the huge Irish organizations, the Fenian Brotherhood, the Clan na Gael, the Democrat Party, which operated in the U.S. You can, since they are a movable lens, rather as Schindler was a movable lens upon every aspect of the Holocaust, these men and women encountered many aspects of the Irish movement.
Okay. We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to get back to the point I raised earlier about your having relatives here interspersed throughout the pages, your ancestors. You mentioned one, if I recall, isn't Thomas Maher, an ancestor of yours, and also the wonderful character Hugh Larkin, I believe, is a relative of your wife. Would you like to talk about them for a moment?
Yes, indeed. Hugh Larkin was, I deal with him because he was a typical peasant activist. The peasantry of Ireland held tenure, land tenure, that was very insecure. They were utterly dependent upon their land for survival. Often it was half an acre, quarter of an acre, on which they grew potatoes, the famous potatoes, kept a pig in their cabin and so on. They're utterly dependent upon this land. So they organized people like Hugh Larkin into informal but oath-bound peasant groups called the Ribbon Men. And Hugh Larkin, on his ship to Australia, of 218 prisoners, there were over 70 ribbon men. And so ribbon offenses were very common, resistance to landlordism, basically. And he was my wife's great-grandfather. Thomas Francis Maher was not, sadly, an ancestor of mine. I'd be very proud to claim him. But John Keneally, who was an Irish Republican in post-Civil War era, transported to Australia on the last convict ship, he was an ancestor. And you see in his life the Irish radicalism, but you also see the way the Irish adapted themselves to pluralist America very creatively, the way every immigrant group, if it's going to be successful, has to adapt itself to the pluralism of these new countries like the United States. So I used some of my ancestors as, again, as a lens or a litmus test, as typical people of the great Irish catastrophe of the 19th century.
Well, and if you're just a few seconds we have left, would you care to tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, actually, yes, I'm working in New York on a non-fiction book, which I hope might come out next year. It's much smaller than The Great Shame, but it's about women. It's about women in the 19th century and the way they were put in purdah, the ones who were seen to have sinned. And I'm following the career of a woman who was married to a Union general called Daniel Sickles. Daniel Sickles killed her lover, and she was a young woman in her 20s, and I show how society destroyed her for her peccadilloes. It's a long way from Monica Lewinsky, but the code of ethics was very, very different. But disreputability, which many conservative politicians in America believe didn't exist in the past, they're always talking about returning to traditional values. Nonetheless, some of the traditional values were quite horrifying, and I suppose that's the message that I'm telling in this little story. This is very small canvas. Great Shame is very long, large canvas, but at least the new book will be easier to carry around than The Great Shame is.
Very good. Sounds like one we'll need to get back to you on. It sounds like a great book. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Not at all.
You've been listening to Thomas Keneally, author of The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking world.